stardate December 9th. If you look westward early this evening, you may be able to spot three bright stars marking the corners of a large triangle. Vega, Deneb, and Altair are all in different constellations, but together they make up an asterism, or recognizable pattern in the sky, known as the Summer Triangle. Now, you might be wondering, since this is December, why would the Summer Triangle still be visible? Well, in fact, its three bright stars are among the first to be seen on summer evenings, one reason for the summer in its name. Still, the Summer Triangle can be seen during much of the year. If you see it in summer and watch it as the months roll by, you'll have a good example of how stars arc across the sky from one season to the next. Stars move across the sky in the course of a single night as well, but that sort of motion stems from Earth's spin on its axis. Earth's revolution around the sun is what causes stars to appear in different parts of the sky in different seasons. As Earth moves around the sun, our night sky points out on different regions of the galaxy. Well, by the way, if you see the Summer Triangle, notice the star Deneb, which will be farthest from the western horizon in the evening at this time of year. That star represents the top of another asterism or star pattern called the Northern Cross. Each year at this time, the Northern Cross appears upright in the west after sunset, a celestial sign of the coming holiday. We are Stardate, and we're proud to be heard on stations like WNMC-FM, Traverse City, Michigan, KAXE-FM, Grand Rapids, Minnesota, and KMPR-FM, Minot, North Dakota. Stardate is a production of the McDonald Observatory at the University of Texas. And for the McDonald Observatory, I'm Joel Block.
We now return to our recording already in progress.
What did you say?
We now return to our recording already in progress.
What did you say?
We now return to our recording already in progress.
What did you say?
We now return to our recording already in progress.
What did you say?
We now return to our recording already in progress.
Places and politics. The arts, too. From Bonn, Berlin, and New York. Timely coverage of the events and issues inside Germany that are important to America.
This is Germany Today, December 1989. I'm Lee Murphy in New York with Peggy Trautmann, Don Jordan, Joseph Fleming, and Alfred Schroeder in West Germany. Kohl calls for confederation with East Germany, putting aside talk of early reunification. While governments move with caution, East Germans will share this holiday season with family and friends in the West, beyond the wall. We'll have a pair of reports. Rap music makes a hit in West Germany, at least when the subject is the Berlin Wall. American manufacturers could have a happy, prosperous Christmas and heighten sales across Germany. It's not all good news, as Bonn worry mounts over rise in drug abuse. And finally, a touch of tradition, a carol from kids in West Berlin. Details in a moment on Germany Today. It's inevitable, at some time, says Undersecretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger, and reunification is a goal mentioned in the West German Constitution. But for now, in the midterm future at least, Chancellor Helmut Kohl supports a confederation with East Berlin's new government, following free elections in East Germany, confirmed by law, after which work groups would be formed to develop and follow through on a variety of social and political issues. Whatever happens, and no one's certain about that, the new year may bring us some hints of the European future, and we'll look at them in our next report. Meanwhile, what a fall! The season, the wall, and old hardline communist governments across Europe. And nowhere will these historic events be more apparent this holiday season than in Germany, where Easterners will cross their western border in unprecedented large numbers. First, an overview. Then, one single East German's personal feelings about the happenings of the past 2 months.
What a Christmas the Germans are facing. Holidays of reunion with friends and relatives from East Germany, whom many haven't seen since the Berlin Wall went up 28 years ago. Now that it is crumbling and a fortified 900-mile border full of holes, they will meet by the millions to celebrate a Christmas of peace and hope. many West Germans invited total strangers, and they promised to come. Long separated families will be reunited. Friends will meet who could keep in touch only by mail and phone. The wall was between them. The German Red Cross estimated that around 7 million Easterners planned to come over for holiday visits. That would be almost half of the 16 million East German population. Red Cross Regional Director for the Rhineland, Manfred Wohlers, reported his and other organizations had appealed to the West German population to invite Easterners for Christmas.
We had an enormous response already. 10,000 volunteered, and more letters keep pouring in day after day. Most of them insist that children come along and said they had bought presents already.
The visitors can do little more than window shopping. Their currency is at rock bottom. For a day's earnings at home, they receive just about $2 here, not enough to participate in the Western prosperity. The so-called welcome gift of about $60 cash the Bonn government pays every visitor once a year is enough for some bare essentials, but not enough for the thousand things the Easterners really need and can't get at home. So, the millions who do come rely on the hospitality of their West End relatives and friends, and that they are assured of. Alfred Schroeder reporting from Bonn.
If millions come west, as expected, those are all, each of them, people, with their own private hopes and individual happiness.
Heinz Boschek, a 40-year-old East German freelance journalist, is one of the many East Berliners who were separated from relatives in West Berlin when the wall went up and have not celebrated Christmas with a complete family since then. As Boschek told me on the telephone from East Berlin, this Christmas will really be special.
I remember my childhood in an open Berlin. Very happy Christmas celebrations in my big family all over Berlin. So the communists built the Berlin Wall. I remember 28 years divided Berlin and divided family. This year, I plan to spend the Christmas with my whole family for the first time since 1961.
Boschek, one of the first East German journalists to be blacklisted and intimidated for supporting Glasnost, predicted that religious activity in East Germany will continue to be political also on Christmas.
This year we in East Berlin fought successful for our right to live like a human. This is the hopeful message for us in these glorious days and for the new year. But we know that the shadows of the past are still there. So we go to the church this year not only to thank God. We go there to give a sign. Fighting for real democracy and freedoms must go on.
Heinz Boschek said keeping up the pressure for reforms will be the only way to ensure that the wall will still be open next Christmas. In West Berlin, this is Don Jordan.
A New Jersey businessman knows a good thing when he sees it, and he's seen the Berlin Wall crumble. So he's picking up some of the pieces and selling them, mail order, to Americans eager to purchase a bit of modern history. On the other side of what used to be the Iron Curtain, Eastern Europeans can hear the distant pulsing beat of a new rap hit playing on West German radio stations.
There's a hole in the wall, and it's time to party. That's what this rap song is saying, and that's what West Germany is doing, mixing this feeling of euphoria in with the traditional holiday spirit this year. T-shirts, buttons, records, and posters commemorating the historic event are popular gifts, but the most treasured article under the tree is a piece of the wall itself. A chunk of concrete the size of a paperweight starts at about $50 and can go as high as the bidder. Wall souvenirs, complete with colorful graffiti, bring an even higher price, according to the young West Germans who risk arrest by East German police to chip away at the wall. They say it's a lot of work to drill, chisel, and hammer away at the structure without getting caught, but high demand makes it worth the trouble. Americans are just as eager as the Germans to see a piece of the wall under the Christmas tree. Shipments of the concrete, destined for the United States, continue to leave West Berlin. The souvenirs show up later on the American market. Starting price, $15 an ounce. In Cologne, I'm Peggy Troutman.
But memorabilia of political change are not the only things being sold in West Germany and across Europe. A problem, largely American until now, is spreading like the plague it is. The plague of drugs in a year of worry.
The number of drug addicts in West Germany is increasing as Latin American rings turn to Europe for new outlets and a bigger market. Drug use among young people is rising. In some schoolyards, drugs are being sold almost as openly as in a supermarket. The problem cannot be compared to that in the United States, but authorities fear drugs could flood in if frontier controls in the European community begin to disappear as scheduled in 1990. The West German Criminal Investigation Office says Latin American drug rings have set up secret depots to store cocaine in Western Europe. It fears that even if the drug cartel in Colombia is smashed by the United States, cocaine will be shipped in from other Latin American countries. Drug fatalities the first 8 months of this year in West Germany increased by 60% to total 593. The number of new addicts increased by 50%. Arno Falk of the Federal Criminal Investigation Office attributes the rise to a new campaign of international narcotic rings. Joseph Fleming in Bonn.
If West German entrepreneurs are sending us pieces of the Berlin Wall for sale here, what's heading in the other direction in this holiday season of remarkable change?
Not much has changed this year in West Germany's traditional export business with the United States. American importers again concentrated primarily on German toys, cars, and clocks. But changes in Eastern Europe and the opening of the East-West German border in particular have made themselves felt on Germany's Christmas shopping list from America. Joachim Schneider of the Federation of German Wholesalers and Foreign Traders explains it this way.
Christmas business will be particularly strong if we have a look for our East German friends who had the first chance for 28 years to come over to West Germany and who are actually starving for tropical products and other sort of things like toys or even low-price electronic products which they want to buy here in West Germany, and therefore we think that there will be a bigger demand and some tropical products, especially from the United States, for example, bananas, pineapple, and oranges, and other tropical products like these ones.
The influx of East German shoppers is expected to increase West Germany's Christmas turnover by almost 5%. In Bonn, this is Don Jordan.
So much has happened recently that it's sometimes hard to focus on the tradition of the year-end holidays. Hanukkah beginning December 22nd, and Christmas coming 3 days later. We conclude this report with a touch of tradition, recorded by a children's choir in West Berlin. With it go our wishes for a happy holiday and a healthy 1990 from the entire staff of Germany Today.
The number you have reached has been changed. The new number has been disconnected.
Radio Moscow presents Media Roundup. today's issue, the situation in Eastern Europe, the autumn session of the Soviet Parliament, and other subjects. The weekly Zarubizhzhom believes this year can be described as a turning point in European development and the beginning of a new Europe. The magazine attributes this in large measure to the current changes in Eastern Europe.
Czechoslovakia is one more socialist nation that has moved on to a scene of rapid political changes. The Communist Party leaders have resigned after meetings and strikes that had brought together thousands of people, destabilizing the situation in the country. The new party leader, 48-year-old Karol Urbanek, has reportedly called for more energetic changes in Czechoslovakia. He was speaking at a special Central Committee full-scale meeting. He said changes are what the people are demanding, and he also pointed out that the tense situation in his country can be diffused only politically.
Meanwhile, it was noted in a television report from the Czechoslovak capital Prague that a number of politicians, including the Socialist Party chairman Bohuslav Kučera, called for uniting the various political quarters to outline stabilization moves. Many in Czechoslovakia hope, especially after the Communist Party Central Committee full-scale meeting, that the communists will offer society a constructive program to withdraw the nation from the crisis.
The media have much to say about the events in the German Democratic Republic. The Berlin correspondent of the youth paper, Komsomolskaya Pravda, believes the GDR has entered a new stage of changes. The government crisis ended with the formation of a new cabinet, new in terms of both makeup and essence. The coalition government represents five political parties. Many believe that although the Socialist Unity Party of Germany, the GDR's Communist Party, came out for changes, it may lose its prestige, especially after it virtually gave up its constitutional right to governing. Radio Moscow said, with reference to the Berlin paper Neues Deutschland, the Socialist Unity Party leader, Egon Krenz, agreed for the GDR's fundamental law to be stripped of the article about the Communist Party's leading role. He said the party's influence on society hinged on actions and positions rather than declarations and laws.
At the same time, Egon Krenz believes the Socialist Unity Party of Germany stands a good chance of winning many votes at the forthcoming elections. The party, he said, in an interview with the weekly Moscow News, has a membership of more than 2 million and will take part in the election campaign. Besides, he believes that by the elections, a renewed party will come into being and be able to compete. Egon Krenz, however, said in an interview with the German Democratic Republic television, which the paper Krasna Zvezda highlighted, that regardless of the election outcome, the Socialist Unity Party of Germany is ready to cooperate with other parties to make renewal irreversible.
The GDR events are by and large viewed in the context of the situation in the whole of Europe. What kind of relations will the two German states have? According to the GDR Prime Minister, Hans Modrow, Egon Krenz's forthcoming meeting with Chancellor Helmut Kohl will help answer that question. In an interview with the paper Sovetskaya Russia, Premier Modrow pointed out that two German states bear special responsibility for upholding peace in Europe. This could be the reason why both the GDR and Federal Germany prefer to discuss unification cautiously.
The Daily Izvestia noted those politicians in Europe enjoy growing support who believe that unification is not yet on the agenda. It's more important today, the paper said, to normalize and stabilize the situation, promote European cooperation, and clear the way for reforms.
Account for the realities that exist in the present-day world is also important for relations among the socialist countries, especially in the conditions of changes taking place there. This alone, the magazine Novoye Vreme said, can help them preserve and even improve good relations.
Ample evidence is the outcome of the visit the Polish Prime Minister Tadeusz Mazowiecki paid to the Soviet Union recently. Polish-Soviet relations have become better than ever before. Mikhail Gorbachev and Tadeusz Mazowiecki concluded this at a meeting. Before leaving for the Soviet Union, Premier Mazowiecki pointed out, in an interview with Soviet newsmen, that he was going to Moscow as a representative of state authority rather than any political party. And this, he added, must underlie Polish-Soviet relations in the future. And after the talks with the Soviet leader, he had this to say at a news conference that was broadcast on television. "This has been an unusual visit," he said. "Unusual because I represented the government that Solidarnosc had formed on a broad coalition basis. This government tries to promote relations with the Soviet Union and regards them as a primary element of its policy."
In the many interviews Premier Mazowiecki gave before the visit, he kept pointing out that the statement of the new Polish government on the necessity to push relations with the Soviet Union was not a time-serving bow, nor was Poland's readiness to continue respecting all Allied commitments, including the Warsaw Treaty commitments. Premier Mazowiecki told the TASS news agency that Poland understands what the union with the Soviet Union means, and he said that the Polish efforts to build up economic cooperation with the West does not mean that his country no longer takes an interest in closer economic ties with the Soviet Union.
The Soviet Media Roundup has been prepared at Radio Moscow. The Daily Izvestia believes the key principles of a law on lease could prove a breakthrough in the Soviet economic restructuring. They will, the paper added, if they turn into key principles of economic relations.
The Izvestia correspondent in Parliament reported that the law provides for leasing land, industrial facilities, and factory property. The output will be the leaseholder's property. Step by step, they will be able to buy factories from the government. Under the law, the land cannot be farmers' property, but they will receive it for lifelong ownership with the right to bequeath it. Members of Parliament pointed out in parliamentary debates that lease relations mean a revolution and give real economic power to working people. A discussion of urgent measures for national ecological recovery has commanded great response in the press. The chairman of the Parliamentary Committee for Ecology, Kakimbek Salikov, said during televised debates that Perestroika had lifted the veil of secrecy, covering up grave ecological problems. Papers carried the alarming figures that the members of Parliament learnt about in Parliament. 50 million Soviet people live in cities where the pollution ceiling has been exceeded by 10 and even more times. The Chernobyl tragedy, too, was discussed. 2 million people in Belarusia alone live in the contaminated zone. One parliament member suggested introducing an article in the national constitution on the right to living in an ecologically clean environment.
The paper Izvestia called attention to arguments about the fate of nuclear power plants. Member of Parliament Valentin Rasputin suggested shutting them down. The Chernobyl accident, he said, had been the 27th of its kind. Nuclear power plants bring up to 3 to 5 billion rubles worth of profit, but the elimination of catastrophe consequences costs much more. Dr. Andrei Sakharov, a member of Parliament himself, disagreed. He pointed out that the nuclear power industry will prove indispensable at the beginning of next century, when all the other sources of energy are exhausted. He suggested freezing the nuclear power projects for 5 years, and building an experimental underground plant in the meantime. Besides, Dr. Sakharov urged the government to declare one more unilateral moratorium on nuclear weapon tests. Member of Parliament Petrushenko objected. He said the Soviet Union is now lagging behind in nuclear arms because of the 1986-87 moratorium.
Some members of Parliament demanded ending all nuclear tests, including the ones in Semipalatinsk. The Savitskaya Russia correspondent reported information was supplied at the session that the tests are already producing consequences.
A Radio Moscow correspondent reported from Kazakhstan, the republic where the Semipalatinsk region is situated, a group of government representatives has visited the test site region. Igor Belousov, head of the group, said in an interview, "The government is preparing a draft act to meet the requests of people in the vast region to end the Semipalatinsk tests. As for the general ecological situation in the country, the government has suggested discussing in Parliament moves to overcome the consequences of the barbarous treatment of the environment. It was also noted at the session that a number of ecological programs are already getting action. Enterprises with an ecologically clean technology are already going into operation." And now on this media roundup from Radio Moscow, some news in brief.
Do not kill the bearers of bad news. Political Bureau member Alexander Yakovlev said as much at a meeting with young people. He was discussing the media and the attitude they command in society. The Daily Pravda reported Yakovlev spoke against reviving the atmosphere of silence in which Soviet society had lived for decades. "Some may think," he said, "the press is guilty of all the difficulties it discusses. Stop criticism and the situation will improve of its own accord," these people claim. "But criticism is disliked because it makes officials reply to the people and adopt measures." Yakovlev described the media as support both for perestroika and for the free socialist community, given, of course, objectiveness and professionalism.
For the first time in years, culture in the Soviet Union will be supervised by a professional. Parliament has, by a majority vote, appointed actor and stage director Nikolai Gubenko, Minister of Culture. He outlined his program both at the session and in interviews. The program is geared to ensuring artists' social protection and safeguarding the nation's intellectual and artistic gains. This means financing a program for supporting libraries, restoring the decayed sites of historic value, and ensuring theater companies and orchestras freedom of enterprise in their touring efforts. Nikolai Gubenko underscored the necessity to transfer the supervision of culture to the Union and Autonomous Republics. At the same time, he warned against national self-isolation and promised to promote cooperation with the church, informal organizations, and immigrant groups for the sake of the nation's spiritual revival.
It has become known that the program for restoring Armenia, which was hit by an earthquake 1 year ago, is not being carried out. The quake left more than 500,000 people without shelter. Builders from various cities and other nations are constructing cities, towns, and villages anew. The disaster zone was to be revived during 2 years. But the paper Krasnaya Zvezda said most people in Leninakan, for one, still have no shelter. The protracted conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan bears a measure of responsibility. The quake-hit regions were getting no building cargoes at the time. The public demands correcting the situation at once.
Soviet doctors have concluded that the AIDS proliferation in the Soviet Union is still anyone's guess. Officials say the country has 12 sick people, and the number of those who have tested positively is 338. But Radio Moscow said, with reference to experts, the number of virus carriers may be much greater. A little more than 10% of the population have been tested to date. Doctors believe an AIDS outbreak may hit the nation in the mid-90s. Precautions are being taken.
The family continues to attract young people in the Soviet Union despite the increased divorce rate. According to a sociological poll summed up in the weekly Ogonek, 37% said family life helps you feel needed. 7% said family life means having a steady sexual partner. And most said the family helps strengthen moral principles in society. Among the negative aspects of family life, many men pointed to limited freedom, and women, an obstacle to career.
Music. And that ends Media Roundup, prepared at Radio Moscow.
Glasnost has hit you right between the eyes when you hear the Dead Kennedys on Radio Moscow. Can't believe it. Can't believe they stuck that on the tape. Amazing. All right, they didn't stick it on the tape. I played the record. But the day is coming, mark my words. The day is coming when you'll hear Dead Kennedys, Ramones, whatever. You'll hear it on Radio Moscow. And then we'll have to figure out how to compete with them. Well, program's Brain Damage. Our phone number is 632-6901, and I promise we'll get to the phones. But first, one more country. There's just so many tapes coming in, and I'm sure you've all heard of this country. But maybe you haven't, and if so, if not, it will be an educational experience. 632-6901.
Report from France, a monthly review of French politics, culture, science, and technology. Hello, I'm George Kazolias. The 12 European heads of state and government meet in Paris at an informal dinner to discuss Eastern Europe. 350 Soviets are in France to convince the skeptical French Perestroika is for real and deserves their support. 80 delegates from 35 countries came to Paris for a two-day conference to talk about political violence. Paris is once again the fashion center of the world. But what is fashion? And finally, the Beaujolais Nouveau has arrived. The rapid pace of changes in Eastern Europe and the upcoming Bush-Gorbachev summit prompted the 12 European Community heads of state and government to meet in Paris on Saturday, November the 18th. What came out of the meeting is that for the EEC, the bottom line is they will help the East economically if the Warsaw Pact countries come further towards Western-style democracy. The European leaders also made it clear that President George Bush and his Soviet counterpart Mikhail Gorbachev can talk about Europe, but they cannot talk in the name of Europe. French President François Mitterrand summed up the EEC position on Eastern Europe.
Nous sommes prêts à coopérer, à contribuer par tous nos moyens.
It is that...
Deux mots.
But I think there's a... Those in two words.
D'une part, solidarité.
One word is solidarity. Solidarity with the whole of Europe.
Car nous attendons
Because
toute l'Europe.
We are awaiting the whole of Europe.
De la démocratie, quand on pense.
The whole of Europe should come to the meeting, the rendezvous with democracy.
French President François Mitterrand speaking through his interpreter. Ireland's Prime Minister, Charles Haughey, says the mood of the 12 was one of really helping the Eastern European countries.
The mood this evening was entirely concentrating on how can we, as a community, help this movement towards democracy that is manifesting itself in Eastern Europe. What are the specific things we can do to help? What should we be doing? And there was unanimity in that mood and in that approach. The overwhelming majority of the leaders of the community would say that it is necessary that the community should speed up its progress towards unity and integration as a result of what's happening in Eastern Europe rather than the reverse. Now, there may be some doubts in some people's mind as to the speed at which that should happen, but certainly it didn't surface at all today.
Ireland's Prime Minister, Charles Haughey, at the Paris EEC informal dinner. Ireland will take over the chairmanship of the EEC from France in January. France is one of those countries where the people have remained the most skeptical of Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev and cautious towards his perestroika. Gorbachev's French visit last July didn't really convince the French, so the Soviet Union decided to send 350 people of all walks of life to explain perestroika to the French. The mission was called Dialogue 89. Edouard Ivanian is a historian and a member of the Dialogue 89 delegation.
Being an historian, I have all the reasons to say that we have got in the Soviet Union another revolution. There is not a single aspect of the public or political life or economic life in the Soviet Union that hasn't been touched by the perestroika. So everything changes in the Soviet Union. We are hoping to build a new democratic, really democratic society.
What do you mean by democratic? A multi-party system? Edward Ivanian.
The time might come, not today, not tomorrow, but certainly the time will come when the talk about multi-party system might be more realistic than today. Today it is a little bit too early, because the main aim is to change the economic and political life of the society. At the moment, we need unity. So today to introduce a multi-party system will be silly and irresponsible. We are watching very carefully the processes going on in Poland and presently in Hungary.
That was Soviet historian Edward Ivanian. Political violence has become a daily topic on television and radio. What is commonly referred to as terrorism brings insecurity to people living thousands of miles from the actual crisis spot. Paris has just hosted a conference called Political Violence and the Citizen. Some 80 delegates from 35 countries took part in the two-day conference. Françoise Ruditsky is a French woman and a victim of a 1983 terrorist attack. She says the problem for the victim is not only getting compensation.
There is not only a problem of compensation. The problem is to help victims to find their place in the society. Public opinion was very kind to us, and there is a big solidarity movement with us. And I think that now the government knows that they have to count on us. And they know that we are a partner now.
Dominique Vesplez is organizer of the conference. He says we are fighting a kind of war.
Terrorism has become a kind of war. And it's probably the war of the poor. Those who don't have the military power, those who don't have aircrafts and who are trying to change the society by means of political violence, which is not acceptable at all by the democracy in the world. The aim is to try to put together a kind of international committee of experts in all fields, police, investigation, and lawyers, etc., who are going to work together in the coming months, and who are going to monitor political violence in the world and submit advices to the international organizations or to the governments.
Terror conference organizer Dominique Vesplez. Every fall, Paris is the fashion center of the world. For two straight weeks, the big names in fashion clothing were showing their designs for next spring and summer. While France is up in arms because three Muslim schoolgirls wore Islamic shawls over their heads to school, the fashion designers are busy removing clothing, with Yves Saint Laurent, among others, exposing women's breasts in their evening attire. But one question which keeps coming up is, what is fashion? Ronnie Amelon went to one of the Louvre fashion shows to find out.
Anne Flanders is the editor of Detail magazine. What is fashion?
I think it's an antiquated word. Hopefully it's an antiquated word. It sort of relates to times when people were dictated to. I like much more to think about style and of the individual and their interpretation of it. I really don't believe going into the 1990s that we should be thinking fashion anymore.
Joyula, you are designing yourself. What do you think about the arbitrators of taste, the fashion journalists who come here?
You mean they call themselves the arbiters of taste? I think they have one hell of a nerve. Look at the way they look. And they have the nerve to talk about color and clothes.
Are they important people?
Of course they're important. They've got those papers that get out and influence all these people.
Paloma Picasso, what is your definition of fashion?
I think, in a way, if you define fashion, you kill it. I mean, fashion is an evolving thing, so it shouldn't be defined too precisely.
And what is it that makes a collection particularly exciting for you?
Well, of course, it's more exciting if I feel that I can wear, you know, the clothes that I see. Sometimes I can also enjoy clothes that I know won't look good on me. But, of course, it's more funny if I then know that I can also wear it.
As a model, do you have a definition of what fashion is?
A money machine, and keep it going.
Every year in the middle of November, there is a special night when the French lick their chops and bars and wine stores stay open until the bells announce that the Beaujolais Nouveau has officially and legally arrived. This year was no different when at 0 hours, November the 16th, the corks popped and the kegs were tapped. This year's vintage is considered one of the four best of the century. I went over to the Nicolas wine distributors just outside Paris and spoke with Jean Fourniot, Nicolas marketing director, before getting a tour and tasting in the company laboratory. Jean Fourniot first tells us why this year's vintage is so good.
This is due to the sun we have all over the summer, since the beginning of June till the crop. We have the sun on the Beaujolais region. And this have given a concentration of grape, of fruit. We can rate it to the Beaujolais of the year 85. But nobody can compare because we can't have the Beaujolais Nouveau on two glasses together.
Well, I'm presently in the tasting room of Nicolas. It looks like a laboratory with tiles and glass cases all over the place, but you don't have test tubes in the cases. You have wine tasting glasses, and actually the laboratory tables are just chock full of bottles of wine, all different colors. So these are the glasses that they use in tasting the wine in here?
This is Cristal, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So, first of all, we look at the robe, the color of the wine, which is, as you can see, really deep, red deep. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And there is no yellow because it's very young wine, okay? After that, you turn the wine a little in the glass, you smell. You can smell, as if you have a fresh fruit under your nose.
Absolutely.
And a little bit of perfume of flower too. Maybe violet, huh? Okay.
It's traditional to spit it out after you taste it.
But you can drink it, of course. But if you have to taste 20 or 30 samples, that would be better.
For your liver.
Yeah.
Well, it is delicious, absolutely delicious.
If we taste all the wine you have here, maybe 100 bottles, this will be a tasting for tomorrow, for our director of tasting.
And your taster will go through 100 bottles tomorrow?
Yeah.
So that's why he spits it out after he tastes
it. That's it.
Jean Fourneau, marketing director at Nicola Wine Distributors. This is George Kazolias. Report from France was produced by Radio France International.
Probably the most of the international scene that we've ever looked at on this radio program. Three countries we went to. We went to West Germany, the Soviet Union, and France. And here we are back in the United States, and you heard it all on your radio. It's amazing. The kind of things that are out there. Anyway, our phone number is 632-6901. The program is Brain Damage. And we have all kinds of other things to look at that have been going on. This is something that I found in the paper about Polish TV. That's right, an American communications company, get this, has announced a joint venture to wire Poland for cable television and provide it with an array of Western programming. I can't think of any words to describe this. I mean, there's all kinds. The network, which is scheduled to begin in Warsaw and Krakow in June, would, it is believed, be the first cable system in Eastern Europe. And eventually, it'll carry 18 channels. Although Poles can currently receive some Western programs with satellite dishes, the cable service would make subtitled or dubbed foreign programs widely available. CNN, a news service, and ESPN, an all-sports network, are two American offerings likely to be included in the basic service. They even have a price. The basic cable service will cost about $8.50 a month. payable in the local currency, the zloty, I believe is how you pronounce it. And, they have three tiers. Now, this whole thing is all planned out. Three tiers. Tier 1 would be TV 1 and TV 2, which is Poland's two national broadcasting systems, local programming, a sports channel like ESPN or Eurosports, Soviet, French, and Italian channels, it's more than we get, an educational channel, and the European Cable News Network, something I'd sure like to see over here. Those lucky Poles. Okay, Tier 2 will include Discovery, MTV, Disney and Classical Music, European Eureka Channel, American Arts and Entertainment, and a 24-hour movie channel. And Tier 3 would include satellite-received cable channels from Western Europe chosen by an annual plebiscite of Polish viewers. Sounds a lot more democratic than what we get over here. Can't even get Sports Channel and Madison Square Garden on the same system, can we? That's what they're getting in Poland, cable TV. So you see, folks, Glasnost isn't just empty promises. You actually see the benefits. Maybe if we massed in the streets a bit, our cable TV would improve a bit, too. Certainly would be worthwhile for me. And then they say that Prague's Velvet Revolutionaries are recalling John Lennon. Let's see, I'm not sure if they mean recalling him as the way Ford recalls things or the way people recollect. Let's find out. As dusk fell on December 8th, which I believe was the day he was shot, Vladimir Schreier, an advertising agent in a gray windbreaker, stood in a large crowd, a lighted candle in hand, at a tawny stuccoed wall in the part of Prague called the Lesser Side. "They are commemorating John Lennon," he said, nodding toward the crowds that gathered on the 9th anniversary of the slaying of the former Beatle in Manhattan. "When he died, this became a wall on which people spontaneously wrote poetry, like a screening wall, a wailing wall. And just in this place, people made a symbolic tomb of John Lennon." For the hundreds of others who gathered by candlelight in the lane called Rasnova, this was a special way of declaring their faith in what has come to be called the Velvet Revolution for its gentle, non-violent quality. Like the others, Mr. Schreier had walked over the city stones of the Charles Bridge to pause from the movement for greater democracy and an end to communist power. "They gathered here, and from time to time, candles were lit," Mr. Schreier, a 27-year-old, said of Prague's young people, explaining how the wall became a symbol of freedom. "It was nice because it was spontaneous." In the lane on an island that hugs the west shore of the dark Vltava River, students, young workers like Mr. Schreier, bands of conscripted soldiers in uniform and smatterings of elderly people surged through the alleyways, held lighted candles, and listened to folk songs. More than elsewhere in the communist world, there has been a peculiar ebb and flow in Prague between resistance to communism and the world of popular music, which thus became a principal target of communist pressure. Leaders of the jazz section of the Academy of Arts, whose work was known for a spontaneity unwanted by the communist rulers, were hounded, tried, and jailed. Rock bands flooded the underground cultural scene with the message of nonconformity in a world of repression. In the early years, police officers broke up the small gatherings at the Lenin Wall, but stenciled silhouettes of the musician appeared in the night, along with aphorisms and bits of gentle verse. One year, the authorities plastered the wall with communist posters before the anniversary. Last December, for the first time, they did not intervene. This year, amid the general excitement, the throngs were bigger than ever. Rivers of youths flowed across the Charles Bridge, stopping to light candles at the Baroque statues of saints that line it. They filled the broad square on Kampa Island, where ceramic artisans and vendors with tinkling bells spread their tents. At the foot of a winding stairs, young men in parkas and women with buttons supporting the Civic Forum, the principal opposition group, the Civic Forum, that is the principal opposition group, swayed to the message from loudspeakers, "Hey, you gotta hide your love away." Buttons with the Czechoslovak flag, a blue triangle at the left with bands of white and red on the right. It's a tough line to read. Let's try that again. With bands of white and red on the right. Yeah. Said in English, "Havel for President," a reference to Vaclav Havel, the playwright and opposition leader who many Czechs and Slovaks would like to see as their chief of state. Shielded from blistering cold winds off the river, a youth in the distinctive green cap of the Czechoslovak army lifted his lapel to reveal flag-colored ribbons pinned underneath. "The whole hippie movement," the smooth-faced youth said, beaming, "is a movement for peace." "I consider the change situation as a change for the better," he said. This week, he said, the phrase about the leading role of the Communist Party in society had been dropped from the army oath. And in addition to Rude Pravo, the Communist Party newspaper, copies of Mlada Fronta, the youth newspaper that has shaken loose from the censor's grip, circulate on his base. "Tonight, for the first time since the crisis began," he said, "his unit was issued overnight passes." On Monday, when millions of Czechs and Slovaks walked off their jobs in a two-hour general strike, he and the two comrades next to him, as well as the rest of their unit, donned the little ribbons in the camps where, until today, they had been held virtual prisoners since the government crisis here began on November 17th. Their officers, however, refused to allow the show of defiance, so now they wear the colors under their lapels, he explained. "The commander told us he'd have problems," the 19-year-old conscript said. He said it was not good. Asked whether that meant that the soldiers, in effect, could die for the colors but not wear them, the recruit lowered his eyes and replied, "It's against the dress code, they told us." That, I believe, was in today's New York Times, Prague's Velvet Revolutionaries. And it's really something when you think about what's going on over there. They're thinking of John Lennon more than we think of John Lennon in New York. I'm sure more people went to the Lennon Wall. The Lennon Wall? There isn't a Lennon Wall in New York. That's where he lived. That's where he died. Prague. I doubt if he was ever in Prague to start with. And it's incredible how somebody can affect people in a distant land. People that have never seen or been in contact with this person. Well, I guess in a kind of a spiritual way, he was in contact. And it also throws quite a bit of hardware into the argument of rock music being responsible for decadence. Well, all you reactionaries, how do you explain this, huh? I'd like to know. 632-6901 is our phone number. Let's get a few calls, and then we'll go to the phones. What else do I want to talk about tonight? Boy, we've got a lot of potential there. I mean, I'm leaving it wide open. And all the things that the folks from the Soviet and France and West Germany were talking about, feel free to, you know, jump on any of that. The fashion show, the wine tasting, the Berlin Wall. There's all kinds of things. But, okay, I'll tell you what I really want to talk about. You know what I want to talk about? I want to talk about deviance, all right? Deviance, decadence, that kind of thing. And just, where does it fit in, you know? Where does it fit in our society? And what are we going to do about it? You know, perhaps you can define what deviance is and what decadence is and how much of a threat it really poses to us. Okay, well, you heard about this this doctor and his wife out in the Hamptons who were accused of soliciting sex in Oregon. This started a couple of months ago. I remember we talked about it on this program. And, well, the doctor committed suicide only a couple of days ago. And rather a almost definitely a sad way for this story to end. And I remember we were discussing a couple of months ago just what was wrong with what it was these two were doing. They were going around a campus passing out flyers saying, we're having a scientific experiment of some sort, and we'll give you $10 for every orgasm you can achieve while having sex with a mature female, which happened to be the wife of this Long Island doctor. And supposedly it was for some kind of scientific experiment or something like that. And so the student that they would solicit, actually the students would have to respond. They were handed out little flyers, and the student would come or respond or write to a P.O. box or call the 800 toll-free number or whatever they had set up. And the student would respond, and then the student and the doctor's wife would have sex, and the doctor would film them on a camcorder. And that was the extent of it. We asked a few weeks ago, obviously, you know, it's kind of strange, but who got hurt? You know, there was no forcing of anything. There was no violence. Just a bit of strangeness, you know. And obviously, the whole thing had a very traumatic effect on these people. It still is. And yeah, I really wanted to read the story in Newsday yesterday, because that summed up the whole affair rather nicely. But I can't do that. There's rather a long reason why I can't do that. It doesn't have anything to do with, you know, with legalities or lawsuits, that kind of thing. It has to do with a dog. Dog, yeah. You see, the dog that lives in my house has a very unfortunate tendency. Always has, you know. He's been developing this over the years. You know, he started out as such a nice canine, you know, normal in every respect, but then one day things started going badly, I guess is the only way to phrase it. There was this other dog, you see. There was this, this is embarrassing, I can't believe I'm talking about this on the radio. This little, you know, those little tiny ones, right? You know, those obnoxious ones that you just want to, like, kick all the time. Chihuahuas, they call them, right? There's this decadent Chihuahua that lives down the road, okay? And my dog, his name is Walter, by the way, we'll call him that from now on. Walter was, you know, I wouldn't call him a prude or anything like that, but he certainly wasn't the kind of dog that would go out and, you know, disgrace himself in public. Let's put it that way. So what happened one day, I don't know. This crazy Chihuahua sent out signals down the road. You know, dogs can do that. They just sort of spray things into the air, and dogs from all over the neighborhood say, oh, you know, wow, this is incredible, and run away and things like that. So that's what happened to Walter. And Walter is not the kind of dog that that matches well with a Chihuahua. He's about 20 times the size of one, for one thing. So the whole neighborhood got a big kick out of the two of them hanging around doing whatnot, you know. But that in itself, you know, I could take that. I really could. It you know, the shame, the embarrassment of having your dog be seen in that light. I you know, it was tough, but I could have gotten through that. What's bad was, at right about that time, Walter realized that when you go to the end of the driveway and walk to another house to visit another dog, there's a whole world out there. You know, the world keeps going. And then he suddenly got into all this exploring, and he started walking all over the place, exploring place after place. And now, you know, just whenever you let him out, he just wanders all over the neighborhood and, you know, strikes up acquaintances wherever he goes. So it's kind of affected him in a way. He's no longer satisfied with, you know, with just one house. He has to, you know, get to know just about everybody, rummage through their garbage, if you will, you know, that kind of thing. So, got a problem, you know. We've got a problem with this dog wandering all over the place and disgracing himself. And right about that time, another unfortunate habit manifested itself. Well, actually, he always had the habit of peeing on the floor whenever he got really excited, you know. But when he grew, you know, when he got bigger and bigger, he peed more and more. I guess it's, you know, has something to do with his physical makeup or something like that. And it seemed to increase more with this kind of life that he was leading, life in the fast lane of the dog world, or whatever you want to call it. So he gets more excited when somebody knocks on the door that he doesn't recognize, because this is a potential new person for him to meet, and perhaps this new person will lead to new dogs, you know, and new dogs can lead to satisfying his morbid passions, you know. It's disgusting when you think of it, but that's what happened today. Somebody came to the door, knocked on the door, opened the door, in fact, couldn't wait for somebody to come down. I opened the door and said, "Hey, is anybody home?" And Walter went, "Whoa, this is a new person here." And he peed all over the floor. All over the floor. All over the floor. Whew. Never saw anything like it in my life. I saw the aftermath of it. I wasn't actually there when it happened. If I was there, I could have stopped what resulted from this, which is, will sort of tie together this whole story. What do you do when a dog pees on the floor? You got to clean it up somehow, right? What's a good thing to clean up such a mess with? A newspaper. And what was the newspaper that was lying nearby yesterday's Newsday? So that is why I cannot read the story from yesterday's Newsday about the Long Island doctor who killed himself. And I'm sorry. I mean, I tried to find another copy, but the library was closed by the time this happened. And no stores hold on to yesterday's paper. They should, you know, they should hold on to yesterday's paper because a lot of people want to read them. You know, sometimes I forget to buy the paper and I need to find out something and it's gone. What do you do, you know? It should be available in some way. So anyway, with some total loss because I have the New York Times, but we all know, I mean, we all know this, New York Times coverage of Long Island sucks. It's the worst. They even say that. I mean, I know people work for the New York Times and they say, "God, it's the pits. We don't care about Long Island at all." So, buried on page 43 or something, here's the story that was on page 1 of Newsday. A Southampton Long Island doctor convicted of prostitution for soliciting college students to have sex with his wife was found dead, I guess it was 2 days ago now, an apparent suicide victim. The Southampton Village Police said that the doctor, Rodney Thorpe Wood, 60 years old, apparently shot himself in the head. A police spokesman, Sergeant Lars King, said officers were called to Dr. Wood's home about 1 p.m. by a neighbor and found his body there. A family friend who asked not to be identified said Dr. Wood's wife, Nancy Stephen Wood, was out of town and had asked the neighbor to check the house when she was unable to reach her husband by telephone. Now, some background. The Woods were arrested on September 16th in a hotel in Eugene, Oregon, after they offered money to male students at the University of Oregon to have sex with Mrs. Wood, 44, the police said. The police said the couple told the students they were researching the sexual potential of the mature female as part of an Oxford University project. The Eugene police said they learned of the Woods' activities when students reported that a woman, later identified as Mrs. Wood, distributed flyers that began, "Meet Nancy S." The flyers sought men 18 to 23 years old and said they would be paid to participate in the research. 4 students testified before a grand jury that they had been solicited by the Woods. The police said that at least one of the students had sex with Mrs. Wood while her husband filmed and tape recorded the encounter. The student was paid $30, the police said. The Woods pleaded guilty to prostitution on October 23rd and were each fined $2,500. Dr. Wood was suspended as director of anesthesiology at Southampton Hospital after the arrests were made public. He said at the time that he would appeal the suspension, but a hospital spokesman, Alex Sneddon, said no hearing had been scheduled. Neither of the Woods discussed their convictions, referring questions to a Manhattan public relations agent, Ethan Ghetto. Mr. Ghetto said he had talked to Dr. Wood earlier in the week. He said the doctor was distressed, but no more than he had been in the past. The Woods had been seen at church and at the Meadow Club, where Dr. Wood was a member. The Eugene police said the couple apparently had planned to continue their research on other campuses, including the University of Washington, the University of California at Berkeley, the State University of New York at Stony Brook, and the University of Victoria, British Columbia. Now, one of those colleges I just slipped in there to catch your attention, so be advised of that. Dr. Wood originally was charged with promoting prostitution, a felony with a maximum penalty of 5 years in prison and a $100,000 fine. Boy, under a plea agreement, he pleaded guilty to the same charge as his wife, prostitution, which is a misdemeanor. Their lawyer, Richard Arutia, said that the Woods were engaged in legitimate research and pleaded guilty to get on with their lives. Now, you know, I can't understand it. I really can't. We live in such a prudish society. You know, like I said before, who got hurt by this? Nobody got hurt. I mean, you know, they hand out these flyers. They say, hey, anybody wants to have sex with a 44-year-old woman for, you know, research? I'm sure, you know, it wasn't an unpleasant experience for those people. Unless, you know, I mean, getting paid $30 is never unpleasant, is it? I don't think it is. And as for the sex part of it, it was really their choice. I don't think these people were holding guns to their heads. They don't sound like the kind of people that do that. You know, this isn't like a hardcore prostitution ring. It's just two people, at worst, out to satisfy their rather, you know, strange interests. At best, two people engaged in legitimate research. And fact is, somebody was hurt by it. Somebody felt they had to kill themselves, and this, I think our society is to blame for that, and our what do you call it, moral values, that kind of thing. So, that's our thought, my thought on the matter here. You know, it's interesting, in the Newsday article, I do remember a bit of it, they went into some more detail about just what was going on, and they told about how the student was paid $30 to do this. And they said in the next line, none of the students were charged. Like, how could you even consider charging the students with a crime? What's the crime, you know? It's consenting adults doing what consenting adults want to do, you know? I mean, why is the government even getting involved in this, and why are we getting involved in our neighbors' activities? I'd like to know, there's one person out there that hasn't had some kind of a thought or a fantasy that they, you know, don't want to have made public. These people were unfortunate enough to be made examples of, and as a result, well, we see what the result is. Our phone number is 632-6901. Let's take some calls. Good evening.
Hey, Eric.
Yo.
I got some jokes for you.
Jokes?
Yeah.
Oh, is this what I need to hear? Go ahead. What?
What's the difference between you and Andrew Goldberg? About 700 pounds.
700 pounds. Yeah, he is a rather small guy. I don't think it was that funny, though. Good evening.
Decadence.
Yeah, go ahead, Decadence.
All right. Do you want to hear a story? Somebody, a friend of mine, about approximately 3 weeks ago, a little before Thanksgiving, he was walking along Montauk Highway, got a pumpkin thrown at him from a moving vehicle as he was walking across along the side of the road. And laid him up in the hospital, and he just got out about a couple of days ago. And you wanted to hear about that, because you said you wanted to hear it. And
well, that's that sounds like violent crime.
They're in the fear shot, and if they are, let them know that whatever they thought, they really hurt this guy.
Well, now that's just a violent crime, is
yeah.
it not?
Yeah, it is. Well, apparently, they didn't think that it could do as much harm as it really did.
Well, that's stupid, you know. I mean, I've had things thrown. When I was riding bicycles, I would have things thrown at me all the time. Cans, bottles.
I mean, it's not like a snowball.
Yeah, even snowball. Anything can hurt going at a significant speed. Or even if it doesn't hurt, it can distract you enough so that you plow into something or hurt yourself in some other way.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't think you can compare that at all to what, you know, to the kind of things that we seem to be obsessed with lately. You know, all this, like, moral stuff.
Oh, about the professor in Southampton?
Yeah.
I agree, you know, consenting adults and whatever. And, I mean, nobody was hurt except for the fact that one person decided to kill themselves.
Yeah, well, you can imagine, you know, what was this guy going through? I mean, he was a doctor. He was suspended.
Yeah,
why?
There were respected people in the community.
Why was he suspended? Why couldn't he be a doctor after this happened? I mean, it's his, you know, it's his private life, right? I mean, how did that affect his job as a doctor? I mean, everybody knew about it, so it wasn't like, you know, he was keeping this secret. Everybody knew about it anyway, so I don't understand why they had to do that, because that certainly led to him committing suicide.
Yeah, it affected him adversely. I don't know. I have no problem with it. Apparently some people do, and some people make a big stink about it in the papers or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's the result. We see it. And
It's, you know, and you see these, you see these crazy things erupting. You see people, you know, mowing down students at college campuses. You see all kinds of congressmen having sex with all kinds of people they're not supposed to have sex with. It tells you that, you know, inside all of us, there is something waiting to erupt.
Yeah, the evil twin.
I guess so, but
so to speak.
You know, and that's what gets me so upset when I see society, you know, saying, "Oh, these people did this. It's so horrible." Of course, we're all perfect. You know, there's nothing that we would ever do. We're all morally, you know, crystal clear and all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That's why, you know, I get upset at the Gary Hart type things. You know, obviously the guy was up to a few things, but
irresistible things.
who are we to say, you know, that you know this? I mean, it's a normal thing.
Uh-huh.
In my opinion, it's you know, doesn't mean that everybody does that, but it falls within the confines of normalcy.
Yeah, everything's gonna be swept under the rug. No matter whether it's morals, whether it's the environment, whether it's you know, political lies and mm-hmm. corruption, no matter what it is, it's just swept under.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't want to face the truth about a lot of things.
And, you know, if you could find somebody that lived a perfect life, you know, that never did anything that was kind of strange in any way, I wouldn't want to be anywhere near that person because I would be afraid of that person. I'm sure that they're one of those people that just suddenly explode, you know, because they've been holding all this in for all that time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, we expect people who represent us to somehow be perfect. And since there aren't any perfect people, what do we get? You know, we get these plastic TV anchormen representing us.
Yeah, you get a, yeah.
That's what it seems to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So where do you draw the line, sir?
Draw the line between what? I don't know.
Between what's something that we should be concerned with and something that's really none of our business.
It's hard to say. It would have to depend probably on each particular situation, maybe, to look at it and then look at both sides of what's going on. I mean, that's a very open-ended question,
mm-hmm.
and it's hard to just sum it up in a couple of sentences over a telephone line.
It certainly is.
You know, you know, I have a lot of opinions about a lot of things, and I'm sure a lot of other people do, and I know you do too. I've listened to the show about a year now, on and off. Here and there, wherever I catch it,
uh-huh.
and you know, I've enjoyed a lot of the things, all the things people talked about, and your opinions, and you know, and all, and you know, want to just let you know that.
Okay, where are you calling from?
Right now, Shirley. I mean,
Shirley.
Hmm?
Wow, Shirley, you jest. Only kidding. Well, all right. Well, thanks for calling, and keep listening.
Okay, take care.
632-6901. Good evening. Go ahead.
Reality is devastating.
Can't shout like that. We have a motion detector in the telephones, and they just he set it off, and the thing, oh, it's ugly. I can't describe it. Good evening.
Eric, don't hang up. I got another joke, okay?
Go ahead.
Right?
Go ahead.
What, you want me to say it now?
Well, no, say it 20 minutes from now. We'll just, you know, hum a few bars.
I'll call back.
Why put me through this again? 632-6901. Let's get some calls here. I'm going to play Radio Moscow again. Backwards. Don't laugh. I'll do it. Talking about morality, and I'd like to know if anyone out there feels that they're moral or immoral or whatever. It's one of the important issues facing us. Area code 516-632-6901. We've got a lot of other things here, too, but I'll save that for later. Good evening. Okay, good evening.
Why'd the monkey fall out of the tree?
Why do you always get through when you call?
Because I do. Why? Just answer the question.
Why did the monkey fall out of the tree?
Yes.
Let's see. To beat the expensive air rates to China. I don't know. Why?
Because he was dead, stupid.
That's a good reason. Oh, spare me. Well, okay, is anyone out there with, besides the person in Shirley, is anybody out there with a mind tonight? Anyone at all? 632-6901. Oh, boy. I don't know where to begin. What do we do here? Should I take this call? Two calls? Okay. 632-6901. Let's get these calls coming in. Good evening.
Hi, how you doing?
How you doing? Where are you calling from?
Kings Park.
Kings Park. What's on your mind?
You know that guy that just shot himself?
Yeah.
Yeah, that is a terrible shame, I think, because that guy wasn't doing nothing wrong at all.
No, I don't think so.
I don't think he was doing anything wrong at all, and that's indicative of what's really wrong with this country, is that there's too many laws for covering everything. It's a disgrace.
But you see, it went beyond just the laws. Yes, there's laws here too, but also he was castigated by his peers and everything.
Well, his peers are probably doing the same thing, if not worse.
Right. I mean, think of it. You know, I'm not picking on you or anything like that, but I'm sure every single person around has some secret, something they've done in the past. That, except me, of course. That's you know, something they don't ever want to have revealed. And would make them very embarrassed and possibly cost them their career if a lot of people found out about it.
But,
you know?
I'll tell you, what that guy got embarrassed over was actually pretty mild, I'd say.
Sure was.
I mean, you know, there's a lot of people, you know, with all kinds of weird secrets in their lives, you know. And, you know, there's just no reason for this man to have ever been brought to court for what they were doing. I don't see how they could a law exists like that, that, oh, we're going to waste taxpayers' money. You know, who knows how much the legal motions cost, you know, to try this man or whatever. And, you know, it's wasting valuable court time that could be dealt with dangerous criminals, you know. And here they are screwing around with this guy.
You know, whatever they cost, whatever the actual physical or monetary value of this, doesn't compare with the fact that this guy killed himself, you know. And this whole thing has cost a human life now.
This is something really wrong, you know. It's, I don't know what it is, but, people seem to have some kind of moral attitude, you know, and especially in this country. Like, you go over into Italy or France, you know, they're a lot more relaxed on things like this, you know, these little picadillos people get themselves into, you know.
Right.
They really don't go out of their way to, you know, string people up like this. And if you look, like, Franklin Roosevelt, you know, one of our greatest presidents, he cheated on his wife.
Did he? When did he do that?
That's a fact. With his secretary. She was a very pretty girl way back when.
While he was in, while he was president?
Not while he was paralyzed, but he was, he remained friends with the woman for a very long time, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but, yeah, I believe when he was president, or when he was, what was he before he was president? Governor, I believe?
But yeah, that's another thing. You touched upon an interesting point. Is so-called...
Kennedy was the same way.
So-called...
Well-known.
So-called cheating on one's spouse. I mean, you know, it's not something that should be looked forward to. But also, I don't think it's such a major deal, you know, that you can't go back again. You can't fix, you know, whatever has happened.
I don't know if
cheating is even the right word. Sometimes
it's no reason to hang a man. It certainly has no ability on his qualifications for office. The only thing I could see is that maybe. That he was, you know, he should have actually known better than to, you know, get caught or even get involved when he was in a situation where, you know, he would be publicly exposed under the clique lights. Oh, this is what you've did, you know, you're a wash-up, just like Gary Hart, you know.
Yeah, but you see, you know, if he was able to succeed in not getting caught, that would make him a lot more devious, you know, a lot more cunning.
No, not necessarily. Yeah, I mean, as long as he wasn't, like, publicly exposed, like Kennedy. You know, it's a known fact he had affairs, but that wasn't publicly exposed till after he was dead.
Yeah.
You know, and he did, you know, he did a lot of good things when he was president, and I don't think that the same thing with FDR. I don't think that your marital problems really have any bearing on your ability to do what you do in office.
No, of course
not. Your
talents
in office, and it's really a foolish thing to kind of, you know, we wind up with these. You know, these images, you know, more than people. That seems to be what we want, you know?
Right, and double standards and everything like that.
It's like our political figures have become like, you know, cardboard men. You know, it's like their faces for something that's behind them.
Right, and I would have, believe it or not, I would have a lot more faith in somebody that has had an immoral thought or two You know, because I know that then they're a human being, you know, and they understand. It's like I would be a lot more comfortable with a president who, you know, isn't hooked on drugs, but has experienced them to a degree, obviously because it's such a major part of growing up.
Well, I think we'll see that as, you know, as time goes by, you know, with somebody sooner or later is going to be elected president that has smoked pot.
Right.
Or knows somebody. Maybe he hasn't smoked pot, but he, you know, I'm sure he's met people that have, say, smoked pot and been friends with them and seen that, you know, that isn't such a big deal, you know.
Right, and then he'll be able to speak, you know, intelligently on the subject because he's at least, you know, seen a little bit of it.
Like, who was that guy, Ginsburg? You know, he admitted or whatever, somebody, you know, not that I supported the man.
Right, right.
They hung him over smoking a joint when he was in college. He was just a kid, you know, in the 70s, and there was a lot of that going around, you know, a lot of reefer around and whatnot. And
unbelievable what they did to him.
Had to smoke a little bit, and the amazing thing is somebody actually came out, you know, oh, I knew him, yeah, he puffed a joint with me one time, you know. It's like, what's the big deal, you know? I'm sure he doesn't do it anymore, you know. It's something, you know, a lot of people grow out of. It's not like he's smoking it while he's at the judge's bench ruling on cases, you know.
Uh-huh.
And it's...
I mean, I actually, you know, I was surprised that Reagan would pick somebody like that. And, you know, I supported him a lot more when I found out that he had actually lived life a little bit.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, you know, a lot of the justices Reagan picked haven't turned out to be as conservative as the opposition made them out to be. Yeah, I think it's like in their, you know, I really don't think that, you know, like at the time when they were being nominated and all, a lot of them were portrayed as like these extreme reactionaries, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them actually are like highly intelligent people, and they rule on these cases pretty fairly.
Uh-huh.
You know, like they had the chance to like totally repeal abortion just before, and they didn't do it.
Well, that's again, that's something that hasn't quite been decided yet. I don't know. Sandra Day worries me though.
Well, not so much. You know what the interesting thing is now is the right to die case. I haven't heard if they've given a decision yet. They might not for a long time. You hear about that? You talking about that at all?
No.
Tonight?
Well, inform me.
Well, there's this woman, I think, in Missouri. And, you know, Missouri has the abortion law, you know, the strict abortion law that went before the Supreme Court and all. And there's this woman who is in a car.
It will place the...
in a persistent vegetative state. She's completely, she has nothing but, you know, automatic nerve responses. And the only reason she's alive is because she's hooked up to a feeding tube, which is different from, say, an artificial respirator, which keeps you alive by artificial means. This is where what's keeping her alive is the food. And her parents, after, you know, this has been years, she's been like this for years, and the doctors say she's never going to come out. And her parents want to have it taken off, the feeding tube, you know, and allow it to die.
Yeah.
But there's some, I believe, the Missouri State public attorney or whatever has challenged them, and the case is going all the way to the Supreme Court on whether or not, you know, they can take the feeding tube out.
Interesting.
And, you know, they have...
It sounds like we've been there before, though.
Yeah, with the Karen... Now, that's the fine distinction, is that it's not... a respirator. It's actually, she's being fed. You know what I'm saying? That's like the legal, the fine splitting hair distinction here. Is that I think they've already ruled that you can take off artificial means of life support, that you can shut that down. But this is different in that it's like nourishment.
She's not in a coma.
Yeah, she is in a coma.
Oh, she is?
Yeah, that's why her mind is destroyed. You know, she has nothing but, you know, lower brainstem, which, you know, regulates breathing and, you know, all the automatic functions of the body. But otherwise, you know, she has nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that this should be an interesting thing if they rule on how they're going to rule here.
Interesting.
You know, I think that you should have a right to die. That if, you know, you don't want to live anymore. Or that if you're in a state like that, you know, that if that was your wish before you became like that, I think, you know, that would be a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like here is the state is forcing these people to keep, you know, to, you know, I mean, these people have to live with this every day of their life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a tough one to argue with.
Right.
Well, what do you think though about people who are conscious who want the right to die? Do you think they should have that right?
Yeah, I think so too.
Uh-huh. I think in that case though, if perhaps the quality of lives was a little higher, maybe so many people wouldn't want to do that.
I don't know. The point is like this: if you were dying from a very painful and horrible disease that you were going to die from, like say, terminal lung cancer.
Right.
And you're just lingering there, just waiting to die. You're in awful pain. You're doped up in the pain. And you know, my mother's a nurse, so I'll tell you that there's no medicine around that can take that pain away.
Uh-huh.
You know, they can dope you up and you won't feel it so much, but you will feel pain. And you know you're going to die. What's this? You know, if you want to die, why shouldn't you be allowed to?
Right. But what about the hundreds?
That's the thing where you get into suicide and all. Is it legal to commit suicide?
Right. But you see, a good number, maybe even the majority of people that commit suicide are under 20, and they're not dying of anything except depression. Now, if you just say, "Oh, you've got the right to die," go ahead and exercise it if you want without doing anything more for those people. I think you're really cheating them.
Well, I'm not talking about suicide. I'm talking about, the right to die in that, if you are suffering from some terminal thing,
you should have
a right to
The right to die is suicide, in effect. I mean, if you're saying...
Nobody's going to stop. I'm not saying that, young kids with their whole life ahead of them should go ahead and commit suicide and make that legal.
Right, but you see, the thing is, you say somebody feeling pain from a disease, other people might feel pain... from something else, or maybe from a mental disease of some sort. Who knows? Just pain of some kind. And when you feel that kind of pain, it's enough.
Yes,
you know?
What I'm trying to say is that, I'm talking about some terminal thing where there's no coming back.
Right. Well, that's how you feel in that situation. You feel there's no coming back.
That's how you feel that you can turn that around.
You can, but you're not the person to know
that.
Right.
I wouldn't, hey, anybody who wants to kill himself, they should think twice.
Uh-huh.
And it's a terrible thing.
Uh-huh.
That, a lot of people, a lot of young kids do, and there's no reason to, because, it can get better. It will get better if you just hang in there.
Yeah, well, try out all kinds of different things. There's all kinds of different ways to skin a cat or whatever.
This is true.
Yeah, so the same way, as far as living your life, there's all different methods to approaching it.
Mm.
If all else fails, move to Alaska and start over.
I know somebody that did, and he married an Eskimo.
Really?
Yeah, he just sent me a Christmas card.
Well, then he would be the first to tell you that they hate being called Eskimos.
Yeah, they're Inuit.
Right, Inuit, they're cool. I hung out with them on Baffin Island.
On Baffin, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
You were up on Baffin?
Baffin Island, Frobisher Bay, actually. It's called the Callowet now, yeah.
And up there?
Yeah, it's a great place.
I always
place.
Wanted to go there.
You should. You should go there.
Always wanted to go. I had a dream I was on there once.
Go in the spring. I think in mid-April they have a festival called Tunic Time.
Right.
And you know about that?
Yeah, I know somewhat about the Arctic.
Well, they have this festival there, and it's a lot of fun. It's worth going up. Eat whale blubber or seal.
And who flies up there?
Sorry?
How did you get there?
You gotta take a Canadian airliner of some sort. I went from...
probably some small plane that flies you into the Arctic.
It's a pretty small plane. The stewardess is where Parker is. Yeah, it's interesting. You fly to Montreal, I think, from LaGuardia, and then you take a plane to Iqaluit or Frobisher Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unusual when you look out the window midway and you see it's all white.
Yeah, right.
And you're going like the equivalent almost to Europe, except you're going north.
You know something that's interesting I've seen about the Eskimos is that, those fur seals that there was a big thing that all these baby fur seals are having their heads bashed in by clubs.
Right.
All right. So this is what I saw this documentary on just about a month ago, and I forget which channel, but they did this documentary where they went up there, and here's all these Eskimos, and they can't take the seals anymore, right?
Uh-huh.
And up there, a chicken costs $15 because it has to be flown in. And here are these Eskimos, and it's like, oh, now they can't, they're going hungry because they can't hunt anymore. That was their livelihood, was that fur harvest.
And, I think the main offense with the seals wasn't coming from the Inuit. It was coming from the Newfoundland fishermen.
Yeah, from the big harvesters. But the ban applies to the Eskimos, too.
Right. I mean, to them, it's a way of life. And, You know, they wear furs, they eat raw seal meat or whale or whatever they eat up there. They eat all kinds of things. Things that we would object to, but it's a different way of life there, and we've really got no right to judge them. That's one thing I learned. I went up there with that same feeling that this is wrong, and then I saw exactly how it was affecting them.
Exactly.
There's not much to do up there, and that's...
It really isn't, and the fur business is a big thing. I mean, there's nothing, in my view, there's nothing wrong with catching a fur-bearing animal, as long as you're not... driving it to extinction. If you're harvesting a certain amount and there's still plenty left, I don't see anything wrong with that.
Or making it suffer in any undue manner. You know, like a lot of what the fur activists are saying is right on track because it's too much pain they're putting these animals through. And you know,
I don't see that. Yeah, I mean, man is a predator. He preys on the animals.
Uh-huh.
Animals will gladly eat you. You think a polar bear would have any compunction?
But they won't leave you in a steel trap for 3 days. That's my point.
Well, they shoot polar bears. But,
do they?
You know, I see nothing wrong with the fur business if, you know, like I said, if they're not just driving them to extinction like they are the elephants and the rhinos.
Right,
their horns.
That's something else. I also think you can draw a distinction here that wearing something simply for fashion, I don't find that really acceptable. When it's, you know, when you're killing an animal just to wear something for fashion, when you're wearing something for...
Wrong with it if there's plenty of animals.
Uh-huh.
If, you know, I mean, if you should be able to wear what you want to wear and not have to worry about somebody splashing your coat with paint. Now, I think fur is stupid myself. I think anybody who'd spend $10,000 on a coat, no matter how much money they have, is wasting their money.
Right, and I think that's some of the hostility that these people are getting is based upon
that. No doubt, class hostility.
Uh-huh.
But, if that's what you want to do, you know, hey, go ahead. If you're not, you know, if, like I said, the animals aren't being exterminated, if there's, you know, they're doing it reasonably in a rational way, taking, you know, a certain amount of animals every year or whatever, harvesting them like they do with the deer.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm glad attention is being brought to this because, you know, there's too much disrespect for the land, for nature.
I agree with you.
Yeah, and there has to be some kind of balance. We have to, you know, at least this way, if the fur industry does survive, it's going to be a bit more filled with morals. You know, they'll say, well, our animals are not, slaughtered in a painful way. They're, you know, gassed or something. I don't know, but...
Well, most of them aren't. Most fur animals are raised in cages and they're shot. Or their head is hit, or else they hit over the head with a hammer. I don't think they do that anymore.
I don't find that very appealing.
But just think, that's how they raise chickens. Why are there so many chickens?
I know.
Because they raise them, because they have to.
But
if they didn't do that, the price of chicken would double. That's
yeah, but
fact.
the way they raised them, I don't know. I just can't.
So what? You're going to kill it, right? You're going to kill it and eat it.
Yeah, but think of this animal. You know, growing up, its entire life spent in a cage.
Well, you know what they do when they're not around? They pick the weakest ones to death. I don't care about chickens. Chickens are nasty.
Well, you know, I might be being unrealistic here, but I'm not
saying let's go out of our way and torture chickens, but, you know, I think these people are being a little unrealistic.
But, you know, at the same time that farms are failing, you know, we have to have factories for chickens. Why?
Dude,
I don't understand why there can't be a more humane way of raising livestock.
Not on such a mass scale. You couldn't do it. And that's the reason why, you know, chicken is an affordable meal.
Uh-huh.
If they didn't use those techniques to raise chickens as far as, and I don't think there's not better, but any more efficient way to raise them than they do. Chicken, you want to eat, you want your chicken to cost as much as filet mignon? Think about it. Do you?
I don't know. Maybe it's...
I sure wouldn't. I like it cheap.
There's a lot of moral problems here, you know.
I think we should, you know, stick to our moral problems involving human beings.
Okay, sir, let me pose this to you. Maybe a happy chicken tastes better than an unhappy chicken? How's that?
I think that's cracked up by the people that sell people in the Hamptons.
I just came up with that myself. I think, you know, there might be something to that where...
I don't know. You know, I have to ask some cannibals this question.
You know, raising something in a cage, I mean, how healthy could the animal be?
Well, they feed it stuff to make it taste as good as possible.
Uh-huh.
They have that in mind.
Well, sir, you've brought up a lot of different things and left me with a world of things to think about here, and I'm all confused now. I don't know which way I'm going.
Well, that's good. That was my intention.
Thanks for calling.
Well, you're welcome.
All right. 632-6901. We have lots and lots of open lines. Lots, oh, reams all over the place. So call now. We only have about 19 minutes left. 632-6901. As you can see, the subject matter has been cast to the wind. We're talking about, you know, doctors and their strange sexual habits. We're talking about chickens being raised in captivity. Talking about the international situation with glasnost and all that kind of thing. We're talking about anything that you feel like talking about. 632-6901. Good evening.
Eric, do not hang up. I mean, do not hang up, okay?
Sir, what is your problem?
All right.
You tell me not to hang up, and then you say something,
listen.
Play a stupid laugh track, and hang up on me.
Listen, all right.
I won't hang
up. What do you think about the water?
I won't hang up if you don't hang up on me. How's that?
Okay.
All right, let's reach an understanding here.
All right.
Now, what is I can do for you, slime?
What?
I didn't say anything. What can I do for you?
Loser.
What was that? What can I do for you, I said.
All right. What do you think about the water pollution today in the faucets and everything?
Oh, I think it's just amazing.
No, they got those things on the faucet and crap like that?
I don't have one of those things, but I understand they're being marketed by these nice capitalist groups that want to protect us from pollution. God bless them.
What do you think about it? You can brush your teeth in with that water and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, you know, the fact that we need something like that. I don't know if we do need something like that. I guess we probably do. But that should tell you something right there. I guess it's the wave of the future, you know, because I don't see us solving the pollution problem anytime soon. I think we're just going to keep, you know, polluting things as long as we want. So we'll just have to depollute it again when we want to use the resources.
You don't have one of those things for your water?
No. I gladly ingest all kinds of polluted crap.
And what do you brush your teeth with?
I sometimes wonder.
I didn't hang up.
Wait, you also didn't let it finish.
Oh, sorry. One sec.
Too late. We missed the best part already. Sir?
What?
You're in a bathroom, right? Right?
Eric, I've been kidnapped. It's Andrew Goldberger.
Oh, no. Wait. Andrew, put that person back on the phone. I want to suggest something to them.
Okay, hold on.
What?
You're in a bathroom, correct?
Wrong.
Well, I think you are, okay? You must be. Either that or you're in a room with a toilet in it that's not a bathroom, which is something I've yet to hear about. In that bathroom is a radio, right?
No.
No?
No.
Why not? How can you hear what's being said on the air?
Kleenex.
A Kleenex?
Of course. Don't you have Kleenexes in your bathroom?
Yeah, but I don't listen to the radio on them.
Then what are you complaining about?
Sir.
Oh, wait. I got a joke to tell you.
I'd like you to do something with the radio and the toilet. But it's going to take a bit of effort.
Oh, wait,
you can probably figure out what it is.
One sec.
Well, we don't have time for this. This is costing us money.
Hey.
It costs $10,000 a minute on this station.
You can't hang up on me. You said you wouldn't.
I said I wouldn't, true.
All right.
Okay, so I'm going to transfer you instead. There we go.
Hello, this is the phone mail system. You may now release the call or hang up.
I'll release the call. Thank you. But that's not the same thing as hanging up. Just to be technical about it. Good evening.
Oh, that chicken caller. That guy is a total crackpot. I can't believe the things he was saying tonight.
Hey, is that a familiar voice I hear?
Yeah, but it's on a different phone.
It sounds like a good phone. This is the best phone you've called in on in months.
My God.
Wait, sir. You are at a payphone, aren't you?
How'd you know? I'm on my way somewhere, and I couldn't help it. That guy's screwed up. He's what's wrong with society today.
Sir, you're on a typical 9X payphone. I can tell.
What's right with society? Because you said a happy chicken tastes better than an unhappy sick chicken.
Well, I would like to think so.
Well, the Indians thought the way you did. That's the trouble with society. Oh, I want to get everything as cheap as I can. This has become a nation of survival, not a nation of living anymore.
You know, you're right. You are right about the Indians. The Indians did think that way. And you know what else the Indians did? They wore animal furs. Explain that to me.
Well, they didn't have any other choice.
They didn't have any other choice, but at the same time, you know, it's, I don't know, I think they reached some kind of a rapport with the animals where, yes, they used them for some things, but they also respected them in other ways.
Rapport is the understatement of the decade. They
right.
used to do rituals for the animal. It died, so that it would provide them with more meat and clothes. They would do spiritual rituals for these animals, hoping that they would allow the Indians to sacrifice them again so they could eat and clothe themselves. Not the almighty dollar. Oh, let me get this chicken as cheap as I can get it. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that guy. I can't believe it.
Yeah, well, you better believe it because
that's the attitude of this society. That was
that's the common denominator.
The things he was saying. He's totally out of tune with nature. Totally out of tune. Well, Ionoskoski is the word.
We're all out of tune with nature. That's the whole problem, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I told you that there's no way we could get in tune until we understand the predicament we're in, but, you know, let's not get into that.
Uh-huh.
But I wanted to make a comment on the sex thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
I agree with everything you said, like, you know, it wasn't a crime and this and that, and I feel that this country is anti-sex, anti-pleasure when it comes to pleasures of the flesh, if you want to put it in that term. Newsday is very anti-sex. I wrote letters to the editor about them because they used to have a Dr. Ruth Westheimer was in there for a while, but they got scared and got rid of that.
I missed that one.
And they don't even have the listing for the Playboy Channel anymore. You know what's on the Playboy Channel? They have all the other channels, HBO, the Movie Channel, etc. But they refuse to print what's on the Playboy Channel, and I wrote them a letter about their boring statistics about AIDS. They constantly write these statistics about who's got AIDS, how many numbers they...
Uh-oh.
Oh, my money dropped there. And, you know...
Did you hear?
All these boring statistics about AIDS, but they don't do anything to educate the public on how not to get AIDS. They're afraid to write about sex.
Uh-huh.
I feel. Let's see what any other calls have to say before the show is over. I'm going to go.
Well, you're just afraid that the phone is going to yell at you for not putting in the phone.
No, I'm not afraid of
that.
Well,
then stay on and listen to what the phone has to say.
You want me to? You love the phone.
I love it when people run out of money, yes.
I could pick on them.
It's great. You know, then they'll say, oh, we'll build the call party, but they'll never figure out how to do that.
I'm not anti-AT&T, though.
Well, you're not using AT&T. You're using New York Telephone.
True, but, yeah, 9X. But the thing is, how else could I get in touch with you so cheaply? There's no other method.
Well, that's because no other method is allowed to exist. There should be an alternative to 9X.
Well, the reason they wanted to charge a quarter for a phone call, I remember in the beginning, was because their analogy was people throw quarters into the Pac-Man games.
I remember that, yeah. In fact, to this day, I blame the kids of America for making that happen.
You want me to hang on here until they do something with the blub 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 blub?
How far away are you?
Well, I'm in Smithtown.
So it was a 40-cent call, right?
Yeah, I'm on my way to some local yokel place, whatever the heck is going on tonight. I don't know.
Well, yeah, you know, I'd like to do that myself, actually, one of these Saturday nights, except I always seem to have to be somewhere.
Well, I don't know. I don't really enjoy it. I just go out to make an appearance, you know, to see what's happening. I don't know.
It's expected of you.
It's more fun listening to these people on the air, no matter how crazy they can be at times.
Well, you know, you were talking about AIDS. Did you hear our Soviet report before where they said that there's 12 cases of AIDS in the Soviet Union?
I find that hard to believe.
Yeah, well, they said 300 or so have tested positive, but only 12 full-blown cases.
Well, it could be true, you know, because don't forget, the Soviet Union doesn't have the free crossing across the borders and this and that, so I can see how it could stay...
Well, they do now.
Getting around. I don't know the epidemiology of it over there, though. You know, we may not be getting the facts.
Supposedly, Castro has no... Cuba, I'm sorry. Might as well rename the island. Supposedly, Cuba has no cases of AIDS whatsoever because any time someone is even suspected of having AIDS, they get sent to a leper colony equivalent.
Leper colony?
Well, they believe in segregating all their AIDS cases.
I don't see how it could get in Cuba. I was in Cuba.
Uh-huh.
And I was there for, you know, when I was in the Navy, and I don't see how anything could get into Cuba, personally. The only way I got over there was on a Navy ship, and I was on a Navy base, and there was no way I could go over to the communist side. It was all fenced in, and it was landmines all over the place, and barbed wire and big rocks.
Doesn't it ever strike you as odd that the United States has a military base on Cuba?
Well, we leased that land for 99 years. I think the lease is about up. I don't know how that works.
And they got to raise the rent quite a bit, I think.
Well, it's sort of like, I guess, like Hong Kong. It's probably the same type of deal where they lease that big democratic area there where all the capitalistic enterprise goes on.
That's going to be a lot of fun in a few years.
Yeah, I really don't know what... I don't think China's going to do away with that because, you know, there's probably a lot of money coming under the table that nobody wants to talk about, just like everything else.
Yeah, just like everything else. Sir, we're going to have to keep figuring out things to talk about here because...
The phone's not doing anything.
Phone's not doing anything, and we're making up for all the rip-offs that we got faced with the strike, you know?
Wait, did you ever see the thing on Channel 13, the Kioskowski, with Philip Glass, with the music in the background?
Right, and Policozzi, too.
You did see that?
I saw both of them, yes. There's a third one coming out soon.
There is? If that was sort of like what that caller who called about the chickens, he should see that. That would open his eyes.
Uh-huh.
They would understand.
Here we go.
10 cents, please.
Oh, there you go.
You have 10 cents credit. Please deposit 10 cents more for the past 2 minutes.
Wait a minute. If you have 10 cents credit, then you're even.
I don't have any more money.
No, but she just said you have 10 cents credit. Please deposit 10 cents. So you already did deposit the 10 cents.
10 cents.
I have a penny. Let me put a penny in. We'll see what happens on the radio.
It'll go right through.
Yeah, I put a penny in.
What's that horrible noise? Are you hearing that?
Yeah.
Telephone
mail,
please.
Yes, Aubrey, we have a question here. The machine said he had 10 cents credit, and then it asked for 10 cents. Does that mean we're even?
No, it automatically allows the first 10 cents, sir.
Uh-huh.
And it's overdrawn past that, and you owe another dime.
I guess I better go, Eric, otherwise the taxpayers are going to have to pay for this call.
Well, I don't know what to do here. It's a bit of a quandary for me, too. Oh, he hung up. Oh, well. I guess we'll never know how that ended, as they, if you hear of a shootout at a payphone somewhere in Long Island, you know how that ended. I understand New York Telephone is getting kind of strict about that kind of thing. 632-6901, whether you're at a payphone, and it's pretty cold outside. It's only -3 degrees. Oh, it's that's Celsius, of course, but that's 27 on the Fahrenheit scale. That man was out on the street making a payphone call for all that time just to talk to you, our listeners. And how do you thank him? By leaving an open line on our switchboard. That's disgusting, I think. 632-6901. Fill up that switchboard now, please. Thank you. Good evening.
Hi, Eric.
Hi, Adam. How are you?
All right.
You got a horrible hum on your line. You're also talking on the cordless phone, aren't you?
No, I'm not.
You're talking on something that...
I'm talking on my piece of crap Conair phone.
It's really bad. It's really bad.
Are you serious?
That's awful. But go ahead. What do you have to say? Maybe it'll make up for it.
All right. Let's see. First of all, about the chicken thing.
Yeah.
I know about how raising, you know, chickens in little pens has anything to do with, you know, rapport with nature. I'd like you to explain that one to me.
Well, first of all, it's not a rapport. That's a musical type of thing. Rapport. It's not a... Well, because... I don't know. You're turning something...
You have chickens in a warehouse in these cages. What does that have to do... With, you know...
They don't see the sun, okay? They don't have fresh air. It probably stinks in whatever place they're in. And the environment is just...
Eric, put it this way. There are cages stacked one on top of the other, and they sit and they do things on top of each other. The only lucky chicken is the one on the top, but he has to smell it all.
Right, and you don't know which chicken you're buying when you go to the store. The one
on
the top?
Yeah, they sell, you know, for, you know, 10 cents less, you can get the bottom chicken. But for a buck more, pal, you can get the top chicken, yeah.
It's, you know, I'm sure people go to farms, okay? People go to farms and buy chickens there, right? Why do they do that? Are they crazy? No, they believe that they're of better quality. You know, nobody goes straight to the factory to buy a chicken. They go to the store where it comes from the factory. But people go to farms because obviously there's a reason to, you know, there's a benefit by doing things naturally.
So, Eric, how many people are there in the United States?
Quite a few from what I last heard.
250 million?
Right, I know. It's a problem.
Well, here's my question, all right?
Yeah?
If you raised chickens like that, so they were out in the open air, how many do you think you'd be able to feed 250 million Americans with the amount of chickens they eat each year?
You know, that's the kind of question we should ask before we create 250 million Americans.
Should they eat other nasty things like beef, which causes things like high blood pressure because of the cholesterol, which is allowed to walk around, you know, and get fresh air and all kinds of things like that?
Well, okay. That you raised a good point. If there's room for all those beef machines to walk around, right? How come there's not room for all the chickens to walk around? Ha! I got you.
No, you haven't. There's not enough room for all the beef and the chickens.
And don't tell me that the beef things, the cows, I guess we call them, will step on the chickens or something like that. It's not true.
Exactly.
Because chickens
can
fly.
Room for the beef thing. and the chicken.
So yeah, your logic's running out, isn't it?
No, I usually call them cows.
Unless they keep cows in factories too. I don't think they do.
No, they don't feed cows in factories.
Okay, so why do they have to put chickens in factories? You know, there's enough space for both, I think.
Cows, there's not enough room for both. You see, cows, you couldn't put in cages and grow them like that.
If there isn't enough room, perhaps you could attach the chickens to the cows. You could get like three chickens on top of a cow, and then they'd be able to walk around. They'd be outside and everything like that. Even have like a special machine that, you know, they lay eggs on top of the cow with. And then when you buy beef, you buy chicken too, and you don't have to go to the store twice. I don't know.
Give the chickens to the cows, and you'll have, you know.
It's just a thought.
Another thing, did you see the thing in the paper about the guy in Canada who blew away 14 women?
Yeah, I couldn't help but notice that. It was on page 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Yes, it's quite a news story. Horrible thing.
I found it quite humorous myself, actually.
Well, that's wonderful to hear.
Actually, if you think about it, because, first of all, it sounds like something out of some kind of TV show. How often do you hear about a guy who goes into a college, says, you feminists, bang, you know?
Right.
It sounds kind of like, you know, the last, you know, political campaign, liberal bang, you know?
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, yeah, TV reflects reality to a degree, right?
Yeah. And it was funny in a sick sort of way, though, because, you know, it's not something that happens that often, and, you know, the originality of the whole thing strikes me as kind of humorous.
I don't really think it was that original.
Well, how many times have you seen that happen before?
How many, what, people blowing down lots of other people? I've seen that lots of times.
I know that, but you're a bunch of feminists, bang.
Okay, so, that, you know, I'm sure they say something unique in each case, but that doesn't mean it's any different. It's obviously some depraved indifference to life. I'd like to know how that evolves, you know?
Well, I read
this guy said he was emulating somebody else who had done a similar thing in Canada several years earlier, maybe about 10 or 15 years earlier.
Well, there was a... they talked in the paper about the guy's, I think, Algerian father who beat him all the time, beat his brother, sisters, and said that, you know, women were there to serve men and all that kind of stuff.
Lovely. Well,
yeah.
Something to ponder. I got to go to some more calls. Thanks for calling.
Hold up.
Sorry. Good evening.
Hi, Eric. It's Andrew Goldberger.
Hi. You already called. Make it quick.
Okay. I'd just like to say that there's a fraud going around, and I'm just going to protect the people from it.
There's a what going around?
Fraud.
Fraud? What kind of fraud?
It's called Nintendo Power.
Nintendo Power. How is that a fraud?
Well, they would say that, the kidnapper is still here, okay? Well, they say in the thing that you have been picked. You have been picked from all the Farmingville area. And, of course, that's where I live.
Yeah.
And I'm also a newspaper boy, so I'm carrying around these papers.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, I see in all the other mailboxes Nintendo Power. Same envelope that I got for the other person.
Andrew, let me just ask you one question. Did you for one moment believe that you were picked out of all those people?
I didn't know, really.
Well, I can tell you, welcome to reality. Good evening.
Yeah, about this meat thing.
Go ahead.
Why don't we eat dogs and cats?
That's a good point. You know, people do that in China, and we say, oh, that's horrible. People even eat horses in other parts of the world, and for some reason that's something we don't allow. There's a lot of hypocrisy.
Yeah, I remember reading a story in a newspaper about a couple of Vietnamese guys out in California who were brought up on charges because they ate a dog from some pound or something like that.
Well, you know, it's a question of customs. I mean, you wouldn't try eating a cow in India, would you? Or maybe you would.
I don't know. Maybe if you're Muslim.
Well, thing is, it's different. I mean, some people say pigs make really good pets, you know?
Yeah, well, who knows?
They're intelligent. They're more intelligent than dogs. I mean, to think about it. And they're also clean. The only reason they're not clean with us is because we let them wallow in mud.
Yeah, who knows? Hey, we don't even need to eat meat when it comes down to it. I mean, you can get your protein other places. You know, you really don't even need to eat it. I mean, a cow eats all this grain. All the cows in the United States are grain-fed. So to eat all this grain, it takes, like, I don't know, 4 acres or, I don't know, 4 pounds of grain to get 1 pound of beef. That's a pretty big waste, I think. Yeah. Doesn't make any sense. You know, wasting all that grain on beef. And it's no good for you anyway. Why do you need to eat meat? It doesn't really make any sense. I mean, I eat meat, and I know I shouldn't, but just because I can't, I don't cook for myself, you know, I'm too lazy. That's a problem in the United States. Everybody's lazy. I don't want to do anything.
It's true. A lot of people are lazy. And I don't know. It's something I'd like to go into a little bit more, but we've run out of time.
Yeah, can you play some Albanian folk music?
Yeah, I don't have the Albanian folk music with me, Tom.
I really like that.
I can bring it in next week, maybe.
Yeah, where did you pick that up, anyway?
I got that in the city.
Oh, yeah?
Where else did you get something like that?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Do you favor the North Albanian or the South Albanian songs?
I don't know. I really can't tell the difference yet, but I heard that one clip that one time, and I was really into it. You know.
Look at this. Now we have a bingo. Now all the phone lines are lit. You know, I'm going off the air, and suddenly everybody calls. I don't understand this.
Got to extend the show.
Maybe I should start the show at 11 and go to 1 instead of 10 to 12. I don't know.
You know, I guess people start getting, like, I don't know, like Cinderella or something coming out after 12 or whatever.
I'd like to know. You know, I'd like to hear from viewers, I mean, listeners, whatever they are, you know, readers, all those people out there. Just, you know, let us know when you start listening and maybe we'll rearrange things somewhat.
All right.
Thanks for calling.
All right, Dave.
And thanks to all those people that did call. And thanks to those of you that are calling now that have no hope whatsoever of getting through. It's kind of funny to see all those little lights flashing. But, sorry, we'll try to get to you next week, huh? And stay tuned to USB, all kinds of other fun material I'm sure is coming your way. Eric Corley here for brain damage and all the other associated things. See you next week. Bye.
Get together and party. Be cool. Be a friend when your friend has had
a lot of bourbon, a lot of beer.
Friends, don't let friends drive drunk. This message for
you, the little guy.
Brought to you by this station and the National Association of Broadcasters.
Diane with the concert billboard for Sunday, December 10th. Tonight, there's nothing but tomorrow, December 11th. Paul McCartney starts off 4 nights at Madison Square Garden. He'll be there tomorrow night. No, yeah, tomorrow, the 12th. Oh, the 12th, 14th, 15th, and also the 11th. We're a little confused here. Also on the 11th, Motley Crue and Warrens will be at Nassau Coliseum. On Wednesday, December 13th, Kit Creole and the Coconuts will be at the New Ritz. On December 14th, Thursday, The Alarm and Kevin McDermott will be at the New Ritz. Dee Dee Ramone will be at the Cat Club. On Friday, December 15th, The Ramones and Blitzbeer will be at the New Ritz. Icon and Watchtower will be at Sundance. On Saturday, December 16th, The Ramones and GBH will be at the New Ritz. Dave Mason will be at Sundance. On December 21st, 22nd, 27th, 29th, and 31st, Billy Joel is at Nassau Coliseum. All their shows are sold out. On December 22nd, David Sanborn will be at the Westbury Music Fair. December 23rd, Ludacris, Gothic Slam, Sick of It All, Toxic Shock, and Malicious Onslaught will all be at Sundance. On December 27th, Kicks and Danger Danger will be at the New Ritz. Concert billboards brought to you weekdays, 3 and 9 a.m., 4:30 and 10 p.m., weekends, noon and midnight. If you've missed anything or if you'd like to make any additions, give us a call. The number is 516-632-6901. This is Diane on WUSB Stony Brook, 90.1, Long Island's first station of the 90s.
Get it back to you. your style. And too bad you're not a singer.
Oh, but I am. I am a singer.
No fooling.
No, no, listen.
Fantastic. Different.
Hey, I want to be a star, oh, please.
You talk me into it. Contract. Agrees to render up her soul.